Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, and I have a cold, just so you know. Sympathize with me, because it sucks. But more importantly, I'm here today with the fabulous Matt Maves and the delightful Lisa Weir. So I'm the luckiest man in the world, despite my cold, and I beg our listeners not to hold their jealousy against me. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
I want to start off by saying that we'd like to ask our listeners a question. Actually, I'm going to ask you, Matt. Do things happen to you?
I think that things do indeed happen to me from time to time.
Do you experience emotions?
I have experienced one or two in my life.
Do questions occur to you? Do you have opinions?
Usually, but I choose not to express them very often.
That's wrong. You should be sharing your opinions and your questions with the world. And as should our listeners, I'll wager. They also have opinions and questions. Listeners, we'd like for you to tell us about them. For a segment, we'll start calling Your Moment of Truth. All you have to do is go to theshortcoat.com and click on the button at the top of the page that says, Tell Us Your Moment of Truth. Or you can call us at 347-SHORT-CT and leave us a message. We'll play your message on the show, perhaps do a little research if needed, because we want to answer your questions properly. And because truth is relative, according to sophists like Plato, Protagoras, and Gorgias. I've been to Wikipedia today. But we will give you our truth right back at you. And guess what? We've got a moment of truth from one of our listeners. Matt sent us a question. He emailed it to us, so we can't actually play you his voice. I did consider putting his text into some text-to-speech makers.
That would be fun. Yeah.
But I didn't have a chance to do that. But anyway, it was best answered by one of our admissions crew. So I'm going to play that now. I'm here with Amy Ahern from the admissions office. Amy is our recruiter here at the College of Medicine. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
So, Amy, I've invited you here because we've had a listener question. It's a rarity, and we'd like to encourage more of that. So
yes.
We'll talk more about how to do that in a little bit. But let me read this question we got. My name is Matt. I'm 22 years old, and I currently reside in the Pacific Northwest. I graduated from an EMT academy this last June. While I'm happy I graduated and enjoy being a nationally registered emergency medical technician, it sparked an interest in healthcare and medicine that I find insatiable through basic life support emergency services. I have little, and may I add, mediocre college experience. I took a few classes in high school at my local community college and did poorly, primarily due to the fact that I didn't really care and found it was easier to skip classes during the times I was supposed to be at my college courses. Matt, a little aside, I feel you, brother. That pretty much describes my college education. He did graduate from high school. My main question is, is it unrealistic to pursue a dream of becoming a physician? I've also considered attempting the physician assistant route, but I guess Amy can't really address that, so I'm not really.
I can't.
Yeah. She specializes in docs. So would my poor grades hurt me if I retook them at the community college level, then transferred to the university? What do you think, Amy?
It's a good question. First and foremost, Matt, thank you for doing what you do as an EMT. Very important work.
Agreed.
And we're very lucky that there are people like you who are doing this work. So to really answer your question about the community courses, what's your best approach to this situation that you have? And I think, yes, retaking those courses at a community college is an excellent first step. It's an imperative first step. As you go on, those upper level science classes are going to need to be taken at a four-year institution, those like your advanced biology, those kinds of things. But your introductory chemistry, introductory bio, those kinds of things can be taken at a community college, but retaking those courses is going to be the best first step for you if you do want to pursue the route to become a physician.
Well, what about baccalaureate?
Post-bac programs?
Post-bac programs.
Sure. But the likelihood of getting accepted into one of those without retaking those community college courses is low. So retaking those courses at the community college is a great first step. for whatever it is that you want to do.
Okay, so that's a path forward for Matt.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, I'm sure you can't speak for other for other medical schools, but I mean, realistically, what are his chances? I mean, if he does really, really well, if he excels, is his pass going to hurt him?
I think if he knocks those courses absolutely out of the park, I think there's a chance. You're saying there's still a chance. Nice. I think that's one of these things, because is it going to be an easy route to get there? No, let's be honest. It isn't.
And it isn't anyway.
Exactly. But at the same time, if he really knocked it out of the park and could come into an interview with some life experiences and stories of what has changed about him over the path of what maybe, you know, over 10 years, I think his chances are not completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. Again, is it easy? No, but it's not for anyone.
And he probably wants to see what he can do about looking at colleges that are interested in more in life experiences and a well-rounded person than maybe just straight MCAT or all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. The schools that really take a holistic approach to looking at their applications.
Would Iowa be one of those schools?
Yes, they would. Well, absolutely, we would.
I'm just putting a plug in
there. Yeah, but, you know, we don't want a first-year class of everyone that is coming straight out of an undergraduate institution that's always gotten a 4.0 GPA and everything, that has taken all the same classes. We want people, and I think a lot of medical schools want people with diverse experiences throughout their life and are coming to the day where they decide, I truly want to be a physician and I know exactly why. We want those routes to be from lots of different places.
Fantastic. Sounds like you got a good path forward, Matt. Good chance. So best of luck. Let us know how things go. If you want to submit your moment of truth, go to http://. Well, I don't need to say that. www. I don't even need to say that. Just go to theshortcoat.com. Theshortcoat.com. And click on the bright, I think it's an orange button.
Ooh.
I'm a little colorblind. It says talk to the shortcoats. And leave us your message and we'll answer it. We'll play it on the air and then we'll answer it. Thanks, Amy.
All right. Thank you.
So there you go, Matt. Good luck with that. What do you guys think?
That's so exciting. It's like someone talking to us. We're real.
I know.
And I would like to make two clarifications here. One, that Matt was not me.
Sure, it wasn't. No, you've already been. Your past is behind you.
I know, but I just wanted to clarify for any listeners out there. I could see this being confusing.
It is
Matt
a little confusing.
Matt made this comment. And
Matt is a very unusual name.
It is very unusual.
Nobody else has the word.
It's
Matt.
Pretty unique. My partner and I, you know. Matt Gossie is my partner for basically everything in school this semester, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
So we go and say Matt and Matt, whatever.
That's nice.
But other than that, I mean, there are very few other Matts in this world, I'm sure.
Well, now there's three.
And now there are three, yeah. But number two, this isn't a clarification, but more of, I'm very surprised. I didn't realize that we had listeners in the Pacific Northwest.
Apparently we do.
Like, big deal.
We have listeners everywhere, Matt.
Clearly.
Everywhere.
I also greatly approve of the subtle reference to Dumb and Dumber in Amy's response. It was great.
I didn't catch
that. So you're saying there's a chance.
I didn't catch that. I wasn't tracking very well yesterday.
I'm sure it's Dumb and Dumber.
I don't know if that was what she was going for there, but maybe it was.
She should have been.
I hated that movie.
Raises the cool level.
You didn't like Dumb and Dumber?
I hated that movie. There was something about that movie that I absolutely
hated. Just watch it over and over and over and over again, and it will grow on you.
I think that's unlikely, given that I hated it. What have you guys been doing this week?
This was the week of the M2's first path test, so which meant that some of the M2's were studying for pharmacology for next week. I was not one of them. I was kind of worried, didn't know it was coming, so that means that this weekend is studying for pharmacology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did the path exam go for you?
Well, it wasn't a fail, so that's
nice.
Always a positive. Yeah, yeah.
You should be proud.
I'm always proud when I walk out of a test knowing that it was not a complete failure.
That's nice.
Yeah, yeah.
That's nice. What about you, Lisa?
Well, I'm still kind of living in the M1.5 limbo. So The only class I'm taking this semester is MOHD1, mm-hmm. Which starts next week.
Okay.
So I've been sitting in, well, the end of foundations, they started histology. So I watched a few of those lectures, kind of brushed up on my basic histo. Let's just say the second time around, it's a whole lot better. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's, you know, just seeing it again.
Yeah.
And some lots of time sinking into my brain.
Histology is tough.
Yeah. And then, you know, I've just been filling my time with work over at the hospital and my dog and our dog.
Have you been able to see anything that looked kind of nervish yet?
I have not seen any nervish tissue yet, but I haven't done the labs yet.
Why is that? What a strange question.
So we used to do histo labs.
It's very specific.
Dr. Swales is very good about explaining various types of tissue and their appearance on appearance in histology. So it's like he's an excellent teacher and he does a great job. But the one thing that everyone laughs at is when he explains nerve tissue. He's like, well, it just looks nervish. Yeah, and so it's been kind of a joke. That what's that? Well, it's nervish. Obviously, yeah. It's nervish. I mean, that's just a description now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say to that because I think I've said in the past I took histology for fun.
For fun. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, when I was an undergrad, it was terrible. It was absolutely terrible because I'm colorblind.
Oh, that would make that would it tougher. Really yeah, there are a few of our classmates that have that issue as well.
Yeah, what do you do?
They find different ways to do it, I guess. But because that's something. Well, that's something Dr. Swales always says not to rely upon. Don't rely upon color. But I clearly relied.
It's all staining. I mean, you know, what are you supposed to rely on?
Morphology, I guess.
Okay, so the shape of things.
Yeah, shape of things.
And like, I think the intensity. You can see the intensity without seeing the color necessarily.
See, now I wish I had been told that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I rely pretty heavily on, like, that tissue is very pink. That tissue is very purple.
I do that a lot, too.
All right. Yeah, no, I have trouble seeing shades. So, blue and purple have components in them that are similar, and so... Yeah, telling me the blue thing, look for the blue thing as opposed to the purple thing, is just doesn't work for me at all. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Hello, we're back. NPR and ProPublica, I love that name, last week noted that the feds have released data on the payments to doctors by pharma and medical device manufacturers as part of the Affordable Care Act, which is great. It's interesting to see, you know, who's taking what from big pharma and medical device manufacturers. It only covers, though, spending for the first few months at the end of 2013. Fortunately, NPR and ProPublica have been collecting data for the past 4 years, and here's what they found. Are you ready? Have you seen
I'm
these?
Holding onto my hat.
No, it's crazy. I don't think you'll find anything surprising about what I'm about to say. For 2013 alone, there were 1.2 million payments to doctors valued at nearly $1.4 billion. Pfizer appeared to have interactions with the most healthcare professionals last year, about 142,600. AstraZeneca came in second, 111,200. Johnson & Johnson and Forest Labs each had 100,000 interactions. I love that. Surveys conducted in 2004 and again in 2009 showed more than three quarters of doctors had at least one type of financial relationship with a drug or medical device company. So, lots of money changing hands there. I don't think anybody's surprised. Meals vastly outnumbered all other things between drug companies and doctors. But, you know, they don't account for the majority of the costs. So, you know, food accounted for about 50,000 of Amgen's 55,000 payments, excluding research in 2013, about 91%. But they only cost $3.1 million, so it's only 20% of payments. Industry trade group Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America says that, you know, doctors are busy, so we have to schedule their interactions with us over meals, which is a fair point. But researchers say that whatever the motivation, even small gifts like meals can make a big difference. And you can explore these interactions, guys, and relationships at projects.propublica.org/docdollars. I'll put that link in the show notes. And I found it interesting that in these past 4 years, ProPublica has accumulated 3.4 million records, which total only 50% of the market share. So there's probably even more money out there changing hands.
Lots of money. I think big pharma is always kind of a weird subject. Like, we like to hate on it a lot around here, and doctors in general. I can speak up. Sorry.
No.
We like to hate on it because it does. It affects prescribing practices, maybe not always for the good. But at the same time, you have to think about the fact that, like, we really are dependent upon these people to create drugs for us. I mean, the government funding is not out there right now. And it's like, you don't really want to take money from them or anything. But at the same time, like, you need them to make drugs. Like, I don't know.
I do think it's funny that comment about the doctors not having enough time, so they do it over lunch. Not saying that doctors aren't busy, but I don't know if that is the doctor's primary reason for wanting to do it over lunch. That this summer, when I was doing MECO, some of the doctors there would participate in stuff. And of course, because of my affiliation with the University of Iowa, I graciously declined.
Yeah.
Yes, since we're not really supposed to do any of that. But they would do that, and I don't think it was necessarily because they're like, man, I'm so crunched on time. I think they just really enjoyed people bringing them food.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. This dovetails nicely with another story I was going to save for next time. But comfort food, I learned in reading this story. Like, you know, the common wisdom is if you feel bad, you should have some comfort food, or you might seek out some comfort food.
I saw a headline about this.
But it turns out it doesn't matter what you eat.
Yeah.
It's just go ahead and eat. So, you know, doctors have bad days. A drug company coming in with some food, you know, might give them an emotional boost. And maybe that's part of why, you know, drug companies spend money on this stuff. But, you know, because they're like, hey, we can easily influence a doctor who's had a bad day or is super busy and maybe a little worn out. We'll give him some food, baby.
Yeah, well, we know how food goes over with med students and interest groups and stuff. Greatly increases their participation and loyalty.
Yeah.
Hey, you should come join us.
Sit down.
Come.
Look, it's Eric Wilson, everybody. A surprise guest.
A surprise guest.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Hello, everybody. Hello, world.
Hello. He's
wearing a real short coat.
He is. He looks snazzy. He's got a pager.
He looks legit.
Oh, yeah.
You move up in your third year.
He's got a badge that says student. but your point about, the advertising. Well, what was your point?
Are you talking about my most recent one about free food and interest?
No, the one about...
the fact that we rely on them.
Yes, we rely on them.
Drugs for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But why can't they just create the drugs? Why do they have to, like, spend money to get us to use them?
Because
the theory is that's what they're doing. They want to, I mean, it's not theory. I mean, they're trying to tell doctors, you know, these are our drugs.
I guess they're relying
these are what
on
they
the,
do.
I mean, they need the money from the other drugs to make new drugs. I don't know. Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe I've got
all right.
Nothing
that,
here.
That makes sense. That makes some sense. Well, I don't know. What I do know is that, you know, lots of places are a little concerned about this right now, to the point where, you know, like when I was, I probably have said this before on the show. My father, the PA, used to come home with all sorts of swag from drug companies. You know, everything from like Rubik's cubes with drugs all over them. You know, of course, the ubiquitous pens. You know, lots of desk toys and things like that.
Yeah, my mom always got that too. She's a vet.
Yeah.
So she's not, you know, in a big database of, hey, we gave you a really awesome Rubik's Cube.
People. Yeah. So I don't know.
But if
I always loved it because he would bring it home to me and we'd be like toys.
Yeah, I know, it was great.
With drugs all over them. How awesome!
But if people want to learn more about influences, I do know that they're called the Just Medicine Club, right?
Oh, yeah, on Monday night. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're having a thing.
IPE.
Yeah, they're having a thing coming up.
I
just read the email probably a couple hours ago. It was probably from a day or two ago, and I just hadn't read it. You know, yeah. Kind of wait till after the test before reading emails. But yeah, so that's, you want to learn more? There we go. I don't really know a lot about it. I'm not involved in it, but
I think it's about drug advertising, and I don't remember if it's like misrepresenting. I don't know, but.
I did see something about case analysis and or something along the lines
and
of that.
And it's not just
you guys are great
student,
at this. Yeah, by the way. Yeah. You guys are really drum up interest. I don't know. It's about something with things.
Clearly, we read the email very in depth.
I know that M3 Paige, Paige Zoo in Flox community, she's involved.
Mm-hmm. Talk to
Paige.
That's
all I know. Talk to Paige.
Thank you for contributing.
I had something.
It's a good thing you came. We've talked a couple times on the show about things that docs and med students can do to give low-income folks a leg up. Episode 38, in fact, very recent, within 10 episodes, was a discussion on changing the world outside the clinic. In episode 10, we talked with Paul Farmer about his efforts in resource-poor countries like Haiti and Peru to affect the delivery of high-quality healthcare community-based treatment. Well, PC Mag reports this week on how mobile technology is being used to solve the unique and unexpected problems that low-income people face. So mobile devices becoming more and more common among people in low-income communities, partially because, you know, it's a computer. It's a little less expensive than, you know, say, a fixed device, a PC. And so there's a high potential for using them to solve problems. The difficulty is that the people who make the apps are a little bit disconnected from what it might be like to, you know, be poor, basically. So they have a little trouble figuring out, you know, like, well, what is it that I'm, you know, what is it that I can do effectively to help people with health issues? You know, for instance, the Hannah Wright, co-founder of Significant Labs. Significance Labs. They have a fellowship program. Had a fellowship program this past summer. 5 app development teams created mobile tools for low-income folks to solve very specific problems. They were first asked to take the problem. To quote, take their problem solver hats off and just go out and talk to people and try to understand their situations and experiences. So. There were a number of apps created, but you know, they got a lot of applications, I guess, for this. And, you know, the problem of people not quite knowing what to, you know, how to help these people came out, you know, with things like, you know, applicants saying, we really want to help people with their health by introducing them to transcendental meditation, which it turns out low-income folks really don't have a need for. You know, they're just trying to get things done. So, as an example, there's an app for kids for use after cleft palate surgery in developing countries. So, when kids in the developed world are diagnosed with cleft lip or palate, it usually happens while they're still in the womb, right? You know, they get a lot of scans and, you know, they have some tests and they go, oh, okay, there's a potential problem here. Parents and doctors get a lot of time to figure out what the best solution is. Not the case in developing countries where they don't know typically until after the kid is born, and then they don't have the resources necessarily to even go to the hospital or continue following up with doctors. So what they did was they created an app which helps parents, caregivers, etc. Improve their speech and language skills at home. And it's, you know, and the other problem is that even when the kid is born, it might take a long time for that kid to actually have surgery, if they even have surgery.
These are all like smartphone apps?
Smartphone apps, mobile apps. I mean, these are becoming almost ubiquitous at this point.
Your smartphones.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
I wonder about the low-income folks in developing countries. I don't think smartphone usage amongst them is ubiquitous.
Apparently, it's going up. Apparently, it's increasing.
I think cell phone usage is very high, but
yeah,
I wonder about the smartphone.
I don't know. The article I read seemed to indicate that it's becoming, if not very common, increasingly common. And so, you know, as they become more powerful, as they become less expensive, I mean, there's a lot of there are devices out there that are relatively cheap and yet still qualify for smartphone app or smartphone status. So I imagine that, you know, maybe they're getting out in front of it a little bit here. That makes sense to me, what you've said. But yeah, it's apparently so the app helps children caregivers learn how to improve speech and language skills after their surgery is performed. They worked with, a speech therapist in Mexico City. This is in Mexico, by the way, Mexico City, and who has more than 30 years experience working with children born with clefts. And they're doing things like, you know, helping them say things, not like Dada and Papa, but, you know, I need to go to the store and buy, you know, this, you know, so pretty complex things because they're older, you know, these people. Text for Baby is a free nationwide service that sends text messages to pregnant women and moms to help them navigate motherhood based on their due date or the age of their child and their zip code. This is an example of a use of technology that doesn't require smartphones. In fact, the Paul Farmer interview I mentioned before talked about, you know, in Haiti, at the time anyway, smartphones weren't very ubiquitous, but text message capable phones were. And so communicating that way was an easy and efficient way of getting in touch with populations that needed help. So I would argue that you should go out and, that if you're looking for a way to help the world, maybe go out and do a little technology, but definitely get in touch with your population that you're going to help first before you start coming up with brilliant ideas like meditation.
There was a interesting article that last year in the community health outreach course that I was co-leading, there was an article we looked at where it was essentially this text idea. And I think that text messaging is a more pertinent thing for at least developing countries now, where they would send out essentially inspirational texts to people to encourage them to go to the doctor, encourage them to, you know, get prenatal care, all these things. And it seemed like those sorts of programs have had a lot of success. And it seems like a really cool direction to go in is to work on that sort of thing.
Well, and as far as smartphones go, I don't know number-wise, but I spent 4 weeks in Guatemala this last summer, and for those of you who don't know, Guatemala is rather poor, but I was very impressed with, I mean, it's a very mountainous country, and you can get cell phone reception anywhere there, and although maybe not everyone had a smartphone, everyone had a cell phone, and there were a lot more smartphones than I was anticipating for a country that has, like, 50% of their children malnourished and so
I guess the message is everybody needs to communicate and so
well, and I think part of it is it's far more expensive to make landlines and it's more expensive to try and wire someone up get internet out to someone's house, so it's like, well, the cost to do that, it'd be cheaper just to provide you with internet use through cell phones or, you know, using to call people or text people through cell phones. So yeah, much more common.
So let's see. I'm just looking something up here. Trying to pick a bye, Eric. Thanks for stopping by for like 5 minutes.
I'll enjoy my surgery PBA now.
So. Oh, you're going to rock it. South Africa. 33. This survey says 33% of South Africans... No, I'm sorry. So let's see. I'm just sorry. 91% of South Africans own a cell phone. 33% of those are smartphones. And 43% use the internet occasionally or own a smartphone. So, you know, at least in South Africa. And there are plenty of other countries on this list at pewglobal.org that apparently have access to technology of some sort.
This program, this was set up by an organization or a person. They were like, hey, we just want people to come up with good ideas for
Yes.
Low-income people?
Significance Labs is the
organ. Significance Labs.
Significance Labs. Of course, I'll put the PC Mag article link in the... I think, it, you know, it sounds to me like they were trying to address sort of the... They were trying to... They created this fellowship. And they were trying to address the issue of, you know, there's a lot of smart app makers out there who want to change the world, but what they usually do is sit around a whiteboard and figure out what they want to do instead of going out and finding out, well, what are the real problems? I mean, it might make sense, for instance, to say that, you know, well, people need access to more nutritious foods. But that might not be the primary problem, or that might not be the thing that really needs to be focused on. You know, they might need to focus on something even more basic, like, I don't know, just, you know, having an actual grocery store in their neighborhood, for instance, you know.
I think that's always a challenge between the people who are on the ground and know what the community needs versus the people who have the abilities to make that happen, like with tech and stuff. I think if you're a person who knows like public health and tech or medicine and tech, you are in an awesome position to do whatever you want and make good money doing it, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't recommend that one of the things you do to better your income. I wouldn't recommend creating human flesh burgers.
That's probably, I think that's frowned upon in most societies.
Yeah. Well, a British chef is shilling for The Walking Dead's fifth season in the UK by giving away his so-called human flesh burgers. Chef James Tomlinson reportedly used real accounts of cannibalism to come up with the recipe, which is a mix of pork, veal, chicken liver, and bone marrow to create these hamburgers that he's apparently giving away.
Like real accounts of cannibalism, like he had cannibals try it and was like, yeah, that's what it tastes like, or...
I think he read historical accounts of, he researched historical accounts.
They wrote it that descriptively.
Well, apparently cannibals do compare human meat to veal and pork, which, okay, so how much veal do cannibals have access to?
Apparently a lot.
Well, yeah. Noting, they note it's human meat's sweet taste and a stringy but tender consistency. In the 1920s, for instance, journalist William Seabrook traveled to West Africa and said, sampled some human meat delights. He said it was like a good, fully developed veal, not young, but not yet beef. It was very definitely like that, and it was not like any other meat I have tasted. It was mild, good meat, with no other sharply defined, highly characteristic taste. A little stringy, but not too tough or stringy to be agreeably edible.
She just gave you a funny look.
As well she should.
You know, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to see Zombie Burger in Des Moines again without thinking of this.
Let's see. I bet I think this probably will be a successful venture just because The Walking Dead is so popular and people like to try ridiculous things.
They do, yeah.
And so...
I mean, let's be clear. They're not actually eating...
Yeah. No, yeah.
Yeah.
Human burgers, human flesh burgers. Chef Tomlinson reports in his recipe for human meat-like hamburgers that although one should salt and pepper to taste, the less seasoning you use, the more it tastes like human flesh.
Note to self.
More seasoning.
Tool frontman Maynard Keenan also offered to HuffPo some Huffington Post some wine recommendations for human flesh.
Oh, jeez.
In an article from April. It's amazing where the internet leads you. For instance, when eating a human face, a Pinot Noir is best unless you're eating the nose or lips, which go better with beer.
Ah, of course.
Yeah.
Clearly.
So, that's nice.
A lot of research. I don't know. This
has zero to do with medicine, but I just couldn't.
It's hard to resist.
There was anatomy that came up in there.
You talked about ears and nose.
That's true. Thank you. Yeah. Apparently, the nose has a lot of cartilage, and you know, well, I mean, everybody knows that. But apparently, that cartilage goes better with beer. I had no idea. I typically avoid cartilage in all of my meats.
It doesn't seem like the best quality in meats for most people.
You can go to, I'll link to the recipe, I'll link to the recipe, and I expect that for a taste of phlox.
We're a week too late.
Oh,
just past that.
Yeah.
We're a week too late. That would be great for a community lunch. You guys should McCowan, right? You're in McCowan?
I am in McCowan.
McCowan. Go for it.
I may not be encouraging this. I am a vegetarian. This is like extra over the top.
I didn't realize you were a vegetarian.
Yeah.
Paying attention.
I mean, aren't you trying to
eat more human meat?
Decrease the amount of
animals we use.
Yeah, and like decrease the effect of humans' effect on the planet. When decreasing the amount of humans would decrease the effect of humans on the planet.
Ah, why have I never thought of this?
Yes.
See? Perfect candidate.
Congratulations to the world's first genetically modified babies.
What?
They are set to graduate from high school in 2015. TechCrunch reported in late September that the first successful transfer of genetic material to create genetically modified babies was published in a U.S. medical journal in 1997. Students injected 30 embryos in all with a third person's genetic material, and these children are coming of age at this point. The children who have been produced by this method actually have extra snippets of mitochondrial DNA, from two mothers, meaning these babies technically have three parents. It's still unclear whether all 30 babies turned out healthy, but this is no longer allowed.
Yes. Yeah, they're afraid that Khan will be coming.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration no longer allows these things. I don't know why the FDA has jurisdiction here. They cite them as a biological product. Which is kind of nice for those 30
good
people.
Good for their self-esteem.
I know.
So are they doing like a longitudinal, they're watching these people and their health?
Yeah, apparently.
They're just kind of like, hey, we think they're out there somewhere.
I tried to. Apparently this article, and I didn't write down the body that is, that's unfortunate. But I'll link to the article. I didn't write down the body that is tracking these kids, but they have not yet released their health status.
Data, gotcha.
But it's interesting to note that, because this is, I don't know, maybe it's not because. These teens could potentially pass on their genetically modified material to the next generation. So the mitochondrial DNA, right? They could pass on their...
Only if they're female.
Only if they're female. I forgot that. So, even if no other humans are legally able to be created this way in the future, that's out there.
What was the goal of this? What were they trying to... to do,
and well, these babies were created because their parents couldn't conceive. So this was like IVF, basically. And I'm not sure it didn't. The article I read didn't quite go into the exact problem that these parents have, but I assume that this was the way forward for these parents. But no longer an option, I guess. So that'll be interesting. Good luck, first genetically engineered babies. I'm sure you're going to do fine.
I hope so.
Yeah. That's all we have for this week. I know. You're sad. But stay tuned next week. We'll be back I have new outro music. Are you ready?
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Here we go.
Having these headphones on makes me want to dance.
We'll see you next time. Oh, yeah. The Short Code Podcast is brought to you by the Carver College of Medicine and the students of the Carver College of Medicine. I didn't write any of this down. I'm going to make it up.
Ooh,
that's how crazy I am. The Writing and Humanities Program, Medical Student Government, they're responsible for starting this up, helping us out. So shout out to
them.
Thank you, student government. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
The Short Code Podcast is part of the Vocalis Podcast Network. So make sure you go to Vocalis podcastnetwork.wix.com/listen and find some more great podcasts for medical students. And that's all I got. I'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
Bye.